The following message is brought to you by Wise, the smart way to move money internationally. An American sends money to a friend in Australia. An Australian buys from an Indian shop online. An Indian freelancer gets paid by a client in Germany. What do all of these people have in common? They use Wise, which means they always get the real exchange rate and super low fees when managing their money across borders. And you will too. Wise also has a multi-currency debit card, so you can avoid high fees when you shop overseas, online, or in-store. Wise is designed by international people for international people. Try Wise for free at wise.com/world.
A big moment for U.S. borders north and south of us.
The bridge is going to reopen the doors, and we are very, very, very excited to see all the families from El Paso coming right over to Juarez.
You'll just need your proof of vaccination. Also, our reporter takes a wet stroll down the center of a town in South Sudan. A glimpse of the future as climate change alters weather patterns in East Africa. And remember that herd of elephants roaming across Western China?
The first question I ask myself is like, so why the elephants went so far?
The second question, how do you keep the elephants from doing that again? I'm Marco Werman, and for a newly minted Nobel laureate, no surprise that a lot of people missed his books.
No, I know where they've been. They've been reading other people, not me.
All of that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It's good to have you with us today. Another sign of light at the end of the pandemic tunnel. Today, the Biden administration announced that it's lifting travel restrictions at the Canadian and Mexican borders beginning next month. That means tourists, business people, or relatives who just want to visit loved ones are free to cross again, if they show proof of vaccination. You can almost hear the sigh of relief from businesses along the borders. From people like Sofia Soto in Ciudad Juarez, just across the border from El Paso. She works at a science museum there called La Rodadora. So how did you hear about the news about the reopening of the land border, Sofia?
Hi, Marco. Yeah, actually, as you said, today on the news, we heard about the bridge is going to reopen the doors. And we are very, very, very excited to see all the families from El Paso coming right over to Juarez. We know that American citizens are free to come on over to Juarez, but we know about several other families that can't or didn't feel free to do it. So we are very, very excited to hear this new.
Yeah, I'm curious what the stoppage in travel did to businesses, though, there in Ciudad Juarez. I mean, 18, 19 months of the pandemic at your science museum, La Rodadora. How did that affect attendance?
Actually, La Rodadora just reopened their doors about like a month ago. But since March of 2020, we've been closed. And it affected us very, very bad. Actually, we were on a point that maybe we fear that we close our doors like forever, because most of museums of science in Mexico and in other countries close their doors forever. And it was very stressful because we are like a union point for families, for children to learn, to have fun. Picture a city like Juarez without our La Rodadora. It was very, very sad.
So the museum was closed to everybody. I mean, you said you were worried it could have been closed permanently. Practically, how were you able to stay open?
We are not a museum that the government can give us the things we need. And we have to keep looking for people of warm heart that help us.
When you say people with a warm heart, you mean people who were able to provide resources, money, to keep the museum open?
Totally.
When you think about Ciudad Juarez, mm-hmm. Sofia, before and during this border closure, what effect did it have on the atmosphere in the town just over the last year and a half?
Oh, my God. At the town, speaking generally, I think that the pressure on the ambient...
The sadness.
Yeah, the sadness, of course, because it affects the economy, affects not just the economy, affects us emotionally, personally, but we keep going. I'm from here, from Juarez, and I think that Juarez people are very resilient people.
Yeah, that's right.
And we look forward to how to be present, to how to keep going, to how to see the good things on the bad.
When was the last time, Sophia, you actually crossed over to the U.S. to do errands or visit friends or whatever? Was that in 2020?
Oh, my God. Good question. I think that probably more than a year.
Yeah. So during that time, I mean, just at a personal level, how has the border closure affected you?
I have several family there in El Paso that maybe they can come here to Juarez, but me personally, well, I couldn't. And they can't come to Juarez. I didn't see them in all this time that the border is being closed. Yeah, I didn't see them.
That's really hard. So, Sophia, once the border is open, how soon do you plan on taking a trip? And where will you go, El Paso?
Probably to El Paso to see my family. Maybe I can go to go shopping to El Paso, but probably to visit my family.
Sophia Soto is with La Rodadora Science Museum in Ciudad Juarez, just on the other side of the U.S.-Mexico border, sharing her reaction to news that the border will be reopened for regular travel for vaccinated people in November. Sophia, great to meet you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Marco.
As scientists worldwide race to keep up with the spread of the coronavirus, tracking how it evolves, detecting variants, and identifying new outbreaks, they need the latest information rapidly, from all corners of the globe, really. That means scientists sharing their findings with one another in near real time. It requires a massive global collaboration that, as the world's Alana Gordon now reports, recently hit an important milestone.
Each time a virus infects a person, its genomic code changes oh so slightly, like a small typo or dent in a car. Sometimes it changes in a more significant way. Since the start of the pandemic, scientists have been tracking these changes around the clock, from Beijing to New York to Buenos Aires.
It was just work, work, and work.
Stephanie Goya is a scientist at one of Argentina's main labs focused on SARS-CoV-2.
Sequencing this virus, also performing evolutionary analysis and all the kind of analysis needed for monitor the virus in our country.
Doing this gives important clues about outbreaks, mutations, and even vaccine effectiveness. Huria Tagali is a researcher at the University of KwaZulu-Natal in Durban, South Africa.
This was a new virus. There's no textbook on this virus, right? So we really relied on the global network.
Scientists like Tagali and Goya share and compare virus sequences through an open source database. In South Africa, it led to an important discovery.
Just as we were doing our routine weekly sequencing and reporting, we started seeing some interesting and worrying variation in the genomes that we're seeing from one part of the country.
They ramped up their analysis and noticed more cases were linked to this difference in the virus. It became known as the beta variant.
But it was happening right in front of our eyes, and the kind of surveillance that we had been doing for the past several months was finally serving a huge purpose.
Across the world, scientists responded quickly, looking for traces of this variant, testing vaccines against it, and adjusting treatments. This might seem counterintuitive that everyone is so willing to share their research, especially when that's no guarantee their communities will have access to products that might come out of it, like vaccines. But the main database requires scientists to get credit for their work. That goes a long way. Francine Toomey is founder of the Congolese Association for Medical Research in Republic of Congo.
This means that we participate in the game. We are able to say what is circulating.
Toomey says her region lacks resources and infrastructure to track viruses. That void has created gaps in understanding what's really happening and how to respond. She has been trying so hard to change that.
It seems simple, you know? It seems obvious, but building capacity is tough to raise funds, to develop the research culture.
This past year, she sent several researchers to train in Germany. She set up the labs and equipment to do sequencing. It's meant a lot to her to do this.
You are no more an observer, and I think it makes a difference.
Around the world, more and more labs have been opening up this year. At least a dozen countries in Africa are now able to sequence their own samples. During the West African outbreak of Ebola, only one was able to do this. In June, Republic of Congo joined the ranks. Toomey says the information they've been able to gather has been invaluable.
We have seen the appearance of Delta variant, so that's very important.
Toomey would like to do even more analysis, but a major challenge is the supply chain. Ingredients needed to do the sequences cost a lot of money to import. Still, this month, Her lab helped the global effort reach a big turning point. She submitted the 4 millionth sequence to the database, a note that was marked on her sample.
Yeah, we were very happy, very happy. You provide your information, you contribute to the global science.
Compared to the more than million sequences that places like the UK have shared, their work might seem like a drop in the bucket. But Tumi says they're filling in blind spots for their communities and the world. The millionth sequence, by the way, came from Chile. 2 millionth, Mexico. 3 millionth, Singapore. All in the past few months. Momentum's building. The efforts are helping scientists prepare for whatever variants and viruses might come next. For The World, I'm Alana Gordon.
Let's turn back the page and look at medical science 70 years ago. Henrietta Lacks was a poor African-American tobacco farmer in Virginia, a mother of five. In 1951, at the age of 31, she died of cancer. In an odd way, she lived on. Cancer cells had been taken from her body without her consent. The so-called HeLa cells have been distributed around the world, contributing to tens of thousands of studies and disease treatments. To commemorate the 70th anniversary of her death, her descendants gathered in Geneva today, where the World Health Organization gave her son, Lawrence Lacks, an award honoring his mother's legacy.
There's no words that say how much this means to me. Thank everybody.
The head of the WHO, Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus, says Henrietta Lacks' story is a reminder of the importance of justice in global health.
We affirm that in medicine and in science, Black lives matter. Henrietta Lacks' life mattered and still matters.
To talk about the legacy of Henrietta Lacks, I'm joined by Rebecca Skloot, author of the best-selling book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. So Lacks' cells have been used to develop the polio vaccine, drugs for HIV, leukemia, as well as many other diseases and conditions, even COVID. Where do you start, Rebecca, to encapsulate Henrietta's contribution to global health?
It's sort of impossible to overstate the impact that they've had. There really isn't a person alive who hasn't benefited from her cells in many ways. Everything that involves cells today, which is basically so much of science, started with her cells.
What do you think is the significance then of the WHO honoring her now with her family members present?
Hold on. I'm actually like a little overcome by the emotions of hearing those clips. When I started working on this book, Deborah Lacks, Henrietta's daughter, was a woman who had been on a mission her entire life to just get people to understand that Henrietta existed and that she made an important contribution to science and that it had really damaging effects on her family. So to see it go from one woman who was fighting to share her mother's, to learn her mother's legacy in the first place, to this is incredible.
As we consider the inequities in global health laid bare during this pandemic, how do you see Henrietta Lacks' story promoting health equity around the world?
The WHO, their effort right now to acknowledge Henrietta, to share her story, and to use it to highlight these disparities, I think is so important. And it's so fitting that they're currently focusing on cervical cancer, because cervical cancer is a disease that we have a vaccine for, and that vaccine is not equitably distributed, and women are dying of cervical cancer all the time, particularly minorities. And, you know, Henrietta's cells were used to help develop that vaccine, but HPV caused her cervical cancer. That's what killed her. Mm. It's also her cells, and the fact that HPV killed her is what led scientists to discover that HPV caused cervical cancer in the first place. They won a Nobel Prize for that, but Henrietta was never sort of attached to that discovery.
Well, I was going to ask you, because it's even people in the medical profession around the globe who worked with HeLa cells and didn't know who Henrietta Lacks was, that there was an actual living, breathing person behind all this. Why is it important to know that she was this human being that walked the earth?
I think at its core, you know, every cell that is used in a laboratory, every little snippet of genetic material comes from a living, breathing human who had a family, who had a life, who had desires that are often not even thought of in that process. So it's very easy for science to become disembodied and to lose touch with the fact that there are human beings behind so much of the material that we rely on for medicine and science to progress. And, you know, that humanizing, I think, is one of the first steps to recognizing inequities.
Rebecca Skloot is author of The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, speaking with us about Henrietta Lacks, who was recognized at the World Health Organization today. Thank you very much for the interview, Rebecca.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Just ahead on the show, Denmark rethinks how prison inmates connect with the outside. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. Since May, heavy rains and flooding have displaced more than 600,000 people across much of South Sudan. It is unusually wet weather and has pushed the Nile River to historic highs, flooding roads, schools, even hospitals. Humanitarian agencies are also reporting greater need for food and emergency shelter. Reporter David Lemuria visited a South Sudanese city near the banks of the Nile and brings us this story.
Flooding in the town of Bentiu has displaced more than 30,000 people, and the water is still knee-high in the town's market. At the Rob Corner Secondary School, students and teachers step on cement blocks to stay above the water on the way to class. Teacher Wunliet Kwoldak wears rain boots to work.
As you see in this school, it is full of water. Some of the classes, there is water inside.
Earth-moving machines sent by the United Nations are building earthen dikes for people to walk on above the flood waters. Tortungua is the deputy governor of Unity State, where Bentiu is located. He says the area is receiving hundreds of displaced people every day. They are fleeing their flooded homes and farms on the banks of the River Nile and coming to Bentiu for emergency shelter and food assistance. Tungua says the internally displaced people, or IDPs, arrive empty-handed.
All these IDPs you have seen along the road have nothing.
Their cows and farms have been washed out by the floods.
The livestock started dying because of those waterborne diseases.
The UN says destroyed roads have made it harder for people to access help. Humanitarian agencies are using canoes and motorboats to reach people who remain isolated in the wetlands surrounding the town. This kind of heavy rains and flooding are expected to become more frequent as the climate warms.
What I've seen in Unity State is climate change in action.
Peter von der Overath is the head UN Migration Agency official in South Sudan. He says the situation is worse here because there are at least 1.7 million people who were already displaced by South Sudan civil war before the flooding.
And because of that, some people are living in areas where you have regular flooding, but these people don't have the knowledge that the local people have about how to deal with the flooding. And so they're caught by surprise because they haven't adapted themselves to living in a flood-prone area.
As the rain continues, more people are being displaced every day. Government authorities have appealed for humanitarian assistance, but von der Overath says so far it's not enough.
The needs of people, both the people that were displaced by the conflict and people that are now newly displaced by the floods, these needs go up, but the humanitarian funding is going down.
At the main hospital in Bentiu, doctors and nurses fear another crisis, a surge in waterborne diseases like cholera. Already many have been admitted for malaria. Nyambe Ruwech brought her six-year-old son to the overcrowded children's clinic last week to be treated for malaria, but she still fears for other four children. She tells me she fled to Bentiu from a village a few miles away after her home was flooded. But things are not better here, she says. We are still facing sickness and cold. The rains are continuing past the typical raining season, and it is not clear when they will stop. UN agencies are advising South Sudan to plan more flooding as they build new roads and bridges to prevent this kind of suffering in the future. For The World, I'm David Lemuria, Bentiu, South Sudan.
Prisons in Denmark are known for their humane approach to detention. Some inmates get to wear their own clothes or even leave prison grounds to go to work. But a newly proposed bill could change this for some inmates in Denmark by limiting communication with the outside world. The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
The proposed bill would only affect inmates serving life sentences. For the first 10 years of their sentence, they wouldn't be allowed to contact anyone new. All visits, phone calls, and letters would have to be with people they already knew before being incarcerated. Liberal Justice spokesperson Preben Bang Henriksen says this is to stop people behind bars from forming new romantic relationships with young girls.
We do not want young girls to engage with these kind of people. And we've seen examples that they've been married to these criminals while they were in jail. Well, that's very sad. So we'd like to protect the young girls.
The bill would also ban inmates from posting about their crimes on social media or talking with the press. Henriksen says this is to protect people impacted by the crimes, most of which were murders.
They shall not in the newspaper see that the killer is now having a pretty much normal life within the prison. We don't want him to have this normal life.
Henriksen says this bill is in response to convicted killer Peter Madsen, one of the most high-profile Danish criminals in recent history.
The bill is mainly for him, I would say, definitely.
Madsen is currently serving a life sentence for the murder of Swedish journalist Kim Wall on board his homemade submarine. While in prison, he has reportedly connected with a 17-year-old who says she fell in love with him through letters and phone calls over the course of 2 years. And in 2020, Madsen spoke extensively about his crimes in a Danish documentary. Critics of the bill don't support Madsen's behavior, but argue there are very few prisoners who do things like that. Thomas Martin is a senior researcher at the Danish Institute Against Torture.
The problem they're trying to solve is not very significant. I mean, we might have challenging, provocative media stories about very few specific well-known celebrity criminals who act out in certain ways. But the majority of lifers in Danish prisons do not have a dating problem.
Martin says there are only a few dozen inmates serving life sentences in the whole of Denmark right now. If passed, he says this bill would take away vital resources from people who aren't involved in the behavior the Justice Ministry is trying to prevent.
Prisoners' contact with the outside world is a very important positive resource. It reduces conflicts, it increases opportunities for reintegration. So there's little reason to meddle with that without strong reasons, and I don't see that in this particular case.
Critics of the bill also say the proposal could undermine a long-standing concept of Danish prisons. Elna Sundergaard, a legal advisor at the Danish Institute Against Torture, says it's called the principle of normality.
That's a fundamental principle, saying the only difference between inmates and people outside the prison is that inmates are detained. But otherwise, they have the same rights.
Sundergaard says this bill is the latest proposal from the Danish government that adopts what she calls a tough-on-crime philosophy.
It's really more and more punishment, more use of solitary confinement, stricter rules, fewer rights. So I see this proposal as another example of that thinking that almost has become mainstream among a number of the largest political parties in Denmark, unfortunately.
Sundergaard worries this trend will lead to human rights violations in prisons. Preben Bang Henriksen from the Liberal Party understands those concerns, but he believes certain rights aren't and shouldn't be granted to people behind bars.
You don't have the right to freedom. You don't have the right to walk around. And generally, I would say the normal rights that covers regular people in Denmark, they are suspended while you are in jail.
The bill is now in the hands of the Justice Ministry before it heads to Parliament. If passed, the law would go into effect at the beginning of next year. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. The Australian government is returning a large area of rainforest to the indigenous people who've lived there for ages. The idea is to put the land under better management. One of the indigenous leaders says it's about generational know-how.
Our ancestors have been there for 60,000 years, and, you know, they have lived off the rainforest and they live with the rainforest.
That's just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The European Union is stepping up its assistance for Afghanistan, pledging 1 billion euros to help stabilize the country and its neighbors. Afghanistan's economy has been in a severe decline since the Taliban took control in August. Laurel Miller has been tracking this from Washington. She's the director of the Asia Program for the International Crisis Group and formerly worked at the State Department. This European aid package of 1 billion euros, about $1.2 billion, Laurel, can it help quickly stabilize Afghanistan?
It can help staunch the bleeding. It can provide a humanitarian bandage for what is a growing humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan, but it's not going to turn the situation around. It's not going to enable the Afghan economy to avoid collapse because it's not really pumping money into the economy. About half of it is slated to go to neighboring countries, essentially to encourage them to keep refugees and migrants in those countries, in the neighborhood of Afghanistan, and prevent them from going to Europe.
I mean, generally, it seems like a dilemma for some of these Western governments, how to help Afghans without legitimizing the Taliban.
Yeah, I mean, there is a real dilemma here and one that is not fully resolvable. You can help Afghans in the sense of alleviating their suffering with aid for health care, for food, for shelter, but those are bandage measures. There is no way fundamentally to move Afghanistan forward economically and try to address these fragility risks without working with the Taliban. But it has to be said, I mean, what we're seeing now is the real underlying fundamental fragility of Afghanistan, despite the fact that over the last 20 years, Western donors poured billions of dollars into the country.
Well, some 70% of Afghanistan's previous government's budget came from international aid. So now with the Taliban, how can Afghanistan break the cycle and build a self-sustaining economy? Are we not there yet?
We're not there yet. I mean, there's no magic key to that. And one of the key factors that has inhibited development of a self-sustaining economy in Afghanistan in the past was conflict, was violence in the country. We're talking about generational change that's needed here for the economy to be really self-sustaining and growing in a way that isn't just propped up by foreign aid.
Right now, though, especially as the winter months approach, much of Afghanistan needs humanitarian aid. How much aid is needed? Is there a number?
Well, the United Nations has put out an appeal for humanitarian assistance, and they still need several hundred million more dollars to fully fund that appeal, even after what the European Union, Americans, and others have pledged. So the needs are great for the remainder of this year, but there's no real magic fix here.
Laurel, in the weeks and months ahead, who do you expect is going to have to step up here? Or if we put it another way, who's responsible right now?
First and foremost, the Taliban are responsible because the main responsibility rests on their shoulders to make it possible for foreign donors to work with them. Beyond that, it is up to the governments around the world who are concerned about the humanitarian needs of the Afghan people, the risks of people falling more deeply into poverty and hunger to step up and address that.
Laurel Miller in Washington is the director of the Asia Program for the International Crisis Group and formerly at the State Department. Laurel, really appreciate your thoughts. Thank you.
You're very welcome. It's good to join you.
Head to northeastern Australia and you'll find the region of Daintree, sandy beaches and pristine coral reefs. Daintree is also home to one of the oldest forests in the world. The Daintree Forest is estimated to be 180 million years old, a hotspot of biodiversity in Australia, known for its frogs, marsupials, bats, and butterflies. Now, centuries after colonization, the Australian state of Queensland has officially returned the forest to the indigenous people who have lived there for tens of thousands of years. Chrissy Grant joins me now. She's a representative of the Eastern Gugu Yalanji people. Tell us a little bit more about the forest that has now been returned to your people, Chrissy. Describe what's special about it.
For us, it's really special. The Daintree National Park is where the rainforest literally meets the reef. And when you walk into the rainforest, the first thing you notice is a drop in temperature. It's just so cool.
What does the return of this land then mean to you? And what does it mean to have the Queensland government be proactive about this?
From their point of view, it's an act of reconciliation. They've returned a number of national parks that cover a sizable amount of land. So we were just thrilled to be able to be part of the decision-making process in what happens on our country. We have some really important cultural heritage sites that need to be protected and cared for, and the biodiversity relies on us to do everything that we can and to be able to continue our traditional practices of using our traditional knowledge to heal ourselves using the plants within the rainforest.
Chrissy, you're one of several founding members of the International Indigenous Peoples Forum on World Heritage, which is an offshoot of UNESCO. What would it take to duplicate what happened in Daintree in other parts of the globe?
Yes, it's a tricky one because there are, you know, sort of situations happening around the world now with Indigenous peoples that live in national parks, that practice their traditional practices around biodiversity or rotational farming and that sort of thing. And the governments aren't as open-minded, I would say, to those Indigenous peoples as the Australian government has been.
Well, you're leaning into a point that I wanted to ask you about. Research shows that giving ownership and agency to Indigenous groups is an effective way to conserve the natural world. What do you see as the relationship between Indigenous stewardship of nature and biodiversity conservation?
There's a very large percentage of protected areas that is actually within Indigenous people's territories. You know, they've been looking after these places for thousands of years. In the case of the Daintree, our ancestors have been there for 60,000 years. And, you know, they have lived off the rainforest and they live with the rainforest. So that's looking after nature and culture and everything within it.
Chrissy, what are your own memories of the Daintree Forest growing up? What is your personal connection to it?
My mother, my grandmother and my great-grandmother were born in the Daintree Forest, and all her siblings, all my mother's siblings, and there's seven of those. So it's a very big connection for us. And I just can't explain the feeling when I go back to the Daintree, back to our traditional country, and it's just this calming that comes over you that really puts your feet firmly on the ground. It's a really good feeling to be back on country.
Sounds like it feels like home.
It is home, yes. Mm-hmm. Although I don't live there permanently, but I always call it home.
Chrissy Grant is a representative of the Eastern Gugulyalanji people who recently were returned ownership of the Daintree Rainforest in northeastern Australia. Chrissy, very good to meet you and best of luck going forward.
Okay, thank you very much.
Earlier this year, we all got a much-needed distraction, a herd of 14 elephants on an 800-mile round-trip trek across western China, passing through the capital of Yunnan Province, Kunming. Millions of people tuned in online to track the herd's daily movements. It eventually took 25,000 police officers using drones and vehicles to lure them back to their wildlife reserve. Yes, urban areas had to shut down when the elephants came to town. But some good also came from their journey. As the world's China correspondent Rebecca Canther reports, the elephants have put a spotlight on conservation efforts in China.
Becky Xu Chen grew up in Kunming. It's a city of 8 million people. So she was shocked to learn earlier this year that a herd of elephants was heading there.
Because it's never happened in human history that elephants traveled so far away from the original home. So the first question I ask myself is like all the other people asking, so why the elephants went so far?
Chen works with the Zoological Society of London, so she knew they were naturally roaming animals. But this was an extreme case. Decades ago in China, elephants were rarely seen near cities or towns. But since being legally protected in the 90s, the number of wild elephants in Yunnan province has nearly doubled. That increase brings problems as humans and elephants live closer together. Encounters can be destructive or even deadly.
Everybody loves elephants, right? But yeah, if I'm the farmer, I'm also frustrated. I have elephants on my backyard and eating up everything.
Elephants have been pushed out of their natural habitat by encroaching farmland, deforestation, and development. And climate change is also a factor. Last year was an especially dry one in the part of Yunnan most of the country's elephants call home. All that has made it harder for elephants to find the food they need in nature. And says Chen, with no fear of getting hurt by humans, they've gotten a taste for their food.
Bananas, sugar cans, rice. It's just like the sweet shop at the doorstep. And once they learn that, wow, I have free food here. So why they are going back to eat those bland food, those grasses?
The wandering elephants were something of a craze in China and led to calls from conservation groups for strengthened wildlife protection laws. One specific ask was for the government to establish an elephant national park to connect several wildlife reserves, so the animals could travel between them without encountering humans. Zhou Jingfeng is the director of the China Biodiversity Conservation and Green Development Foundation. We want to help them to find new habitat and to expand their habitat, he says, as well as allow them to live alongside humans so that both elephants and humans can benefit. Chinese news reports also highlighted a new elephant canteen being created in Yunnan province. There are large areas of protected land planted with elephant favorites like tiger grass and banana plants. Zhang Xiyan, a conservationist working on the effort, says he hopes those plants will tempt the elephants to stay in the protected area and away from humans. We expect the elephants to come by and graze here probably only once or twice a year, he says. There's enough for them to eat for a few days, and then they'll move on. In the Baduo village in southern Yunnan, villagers are walking in an elephant canteen in a lush mountainous area a few miles from their farmland. They're breaking ground to plant saplings in the soil. Bu Ludu is a villager working on the effort. There used to be a lot of wildlife here, she says, but after we cut down much of the forest and planted rubber and tea, there have been fewer animals. We hope through our reforestation work the wildlife will return. Other efforts are underway, including a monitoring system that uses drones to track elephant movements. Local forest rangers send out alerts on social media when elephants are nearby so people can avoid them. And yes, apparently there's an app for this, too. An automated message will tell you if there are elephants nearby or not, based on crowdsourced photos or videos from other users. But larger efforts are in the works as well. On Tuesday, at a UN biodiversity conference in Kunming, China's President Xi Jinping pledged $232 million for a new biodiversity fund. And conservation groups are looking forward to the news of a new proposed biodiversity law before the year's end. For The World, I'm Rebecca Canther.
The British Museum in London serves as a kind of show and tell about the British Empire. There are amazing things to see, a lot of it stolen or looted. For years now, the museum has been under pressure to return many of these cultural artifacts to their rightful origins. But the British Museum points to a 1963 Act of Parliament to explain why it can't. A new case, however, is testing that excuse. It concerns 11 objects sacred to Ethiopia that have not been seen by the public in 150 years. Samantha Knights is the British lawyer who wrote a legal opinion that says it would be entirely legal for the British Museum to return these objects to Ethiopia. So let's start with the objects in question, Samantha. What are they?
These are highly sacred objects. They are a fundamental part of the rituals and the ceremonies of the Ethiopian Orthodox Church. They're basically tablets. They're usually made of wood, but sometimes stone, and they're replicas of the commandments of the Ark of the Covenant. And they are only ever meant to be seen by Ethiopian Orthodox priests.
How did they actually end up in the British Museum?
In 1868, there was a Battle of Makdala, part of the British Army's expedition to Abyssinia. And the British Museum had agreed to send Richard Holmes, an assistant who was in the museum's manuscript department, on the expedition to Abyssinia to acquire as many cultural artifacts as he could. So he purchased a large collection of items from different sources throughout the expedition. But after the defeat of the emperor at the battle, British troops went on a looting rampage and they plundered items from the treasury and they plundered items from the nearby Orthodox Christian church. Then there was a prize auction a few days later and Holmes bid for various manuscripts, bid for tabos and got them. And then they were brought back and then ended up in the museum and others were acquired by the museum subsequently.
So some of the most famous stolen or looted items in the British Museum, things like the Elgin Marbles and the Rosetta Stone, they've been on display for more than 200 years, but the Ethiopian altar tablets have never been on display. Why were these artifacts never on display?
Well, I think it's because they were so very sacred. The museum accepts their religious sanctity, their very, very special nature, and as a result of that, has never allowed them to be put on display, never allowed them to be copied, photographed, or even studied. So this really does make them very unique in their collection.
So the fact that the British Museum never displayed the Ethiopian altar tablets is a key reason, I gather, you think their return is not a violation of the 1963 Act of Parliament I mentioned earlier. What does that act say?
Right. So the provision says that the trustees of the museum may dispose of an object if, in the opinion of the trustees, the object is unfit to be retained in the collections of the museum and can be disposed of without detriment to the interests of the student. And in my opinion, I set out why, in my view, the tabos are unfit to be retained and can be disposed of without detriment. First of all, they don't have any apparent use or relevance because the museum accepts that they can't be put on display or they can't be photographed or copied or be given access to anybody, except occasionally they do allow access to the Ethiopian Orthodox Church. Secondly, they can be disposed, therefore, without detriment to the interests of students because the students don't have any possibility to view, study them or copy them or do any research. Thirdly, it doesn't appear that they fall within the museum's broader purposes because the museum's purposes are to curate, to research and to exhibit. The museum can't do any of those things with the tabos.
Samantha, how has the British Museum responded to your legal opinion?
The museum received the letter, which was signed by a number of very high-profile individuals, and my opinion was attached to that, just before their trustee meeting on the 4th of October. And they have said that they need more time to consider the opinion by all the trustees.
Samantha Knights is the British lawyer who wrote a legal opinion arguing that it would be legal for the British Museum to return sacred altar tablets to Ethiopia. Thank you very much, Samantha.
Thank you.
Last week was an adrenaline rush for novelist Abdulrazak Gurna. Since his phone rang with the news that he'd been awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature, he's had a few quiet moments. Gurna was born in Zanzibar, a small semi-autonomous island off the coast of Tanzania, but he spent much of his adult life in the UK, arriving as a refugee in the 1960s. Gurna joins us now from Canterbury. Abdulrazak Gurna, congratulations. Last week must be a bit of a blur at this point. Are you settling into this celebrity life yet?
Well, it was a blur, still is a blur, but it's such a good thing to happen. The excitement, the pleasure that so many people seem to share with me. It's all been very good.
Readers who know will know, but many did not know about your work until last week. Do you find yourself asking all those people tugging on your sleeve right now, where have you been all these years?
No, I know where they've been. They've been reading other people, not me. You know?
That must feel pretty good, though, right?
Yeah, it's excellent. Absolutely.
The characters we meet in your stories, are these people you grew up with in Zanzibar?
Some of them. They grew up with me in my mind, you know, in my imagination, as you were. They're how you inform yourself about the plausibility of the people you're attempting to portray or to bring to life in your writing.
Right. So many of these people you bring to life so brilliantly are deeply wounded by various things, various forces. What has injured them and how do they respond?
I mean, we're all wounded sooner or later. I mean, that's experience in a way. What we make of it is part of the process that I'm interested in. What is it that makes people encounter sometimes situations of injustice and of cruelty, but not always, sometimes situations of affection and love and so on. But what is it that makes people then retrieve something from pain and trauma? I'm interested in that.
I mean, a lot of it is about the pain and trauma around colonialism. You said in an interview recently that you write stories that are steeped in colonialism because that's what engages you. It's what you care about. Why is it important to write about colonialism today, right now?
Well, it is part of contemporary reality. It's not colonialism has gone. Colonialism and its consequences are not only still with us, but they actually, in a very big way, fashion the kind of world that we are now living in. European colonialism transformed the world. You could think of North America, you could think of India, you could think of South America, but more recently, you could think of the Indian Ocean world. So it's not so much that it's a historical event. It's an event which happened many decades ago, but its consequences continue to be with us.
So Afterlives, your newest novel, is set in the era of World War I. One thing that has always struck me, having lived in West Africa for about 5 years, are the layers of colonialism. I mean, World War I was just one of those layers, preceded by the scramble for Africa, followed by the post-World War I carving up of the continent, and World War II was another recarving of new boundaries. How do you see the layers building on one another? What part has been most destructive?
Yeah, well, they all have their moments, you know what I mean? You know, and also, it kind of depends on the particular experience of colonialism. Different places have different experiences, both because the, shall we say, the agents of colonialism had different ideological or commercial, or even perhaps in the case of Germany, I think a sort of a military tradition that they carried over from Germany to the way in which they went about their colonialism.
And they were the colonizers in Tanzania, from what became
Tanzania. Yeah, and also I think it depends on when it happened. If you look at the colonial experience of India with the British began there as perhaps the Europeans began in North America as weak. They're just arriving there, kind of relying on other people's indulgence in a way. And then they get stronger and stronger and stronger and impose themselves. By the time you get to the 19th century and the divisions of Africa, Europe, of course, is the powerful, dominant, doesn't need to ask anybody's permission to do anything. And so by then, when that's when Germany comes in, colonial expansion is really conquest. It's no longer mercantile or to do with trade, then gradually turning into something else. It was straightforward conquest.
You were a teenager in 1960 when independence was claimed by many former colonies on the African continent. How do you understand independence, Abdulrazak Gurnah? How did colonialism persist even after the celebratory moments in 1960? And how does it live on today? What do you see on the ground?
Well, it continues because what we thought would happen, we were too optimistic. What we thought was that it would release the energies and the humane desires, as it were, of the colonized. But that wasn't what happened, of course. What happened was the same ugly traits of human beings, greed and corruption and so on. I'm not saying that it's all bleak and pointless and all of that kind of thing, but, you know, it does seem that we go one step forward, one half step back and so on. And in some places, no steps forward.
One of the first books I read when I lived in West Africa was Chinua Achebe's Things Fall Apart, published in the late 50s on the eve of Nigerian independence, set in pre-colonial Nigeria. And then it becomes this post-independence modern classic. Of course, one novel doesn't come close to telling the whole story. What is the role of literature in African societies undergoing transformation and under stress?
Yeah, well, I think the role of literature everywhere is to some extent both to engage and to address issues of the day. Now, the issues of the day may also be about how did you get to here? So there's scope for writing to be about understanding what happened in the past, or just simply also understanding human beings, understanding how we live, how we function as social beings, what is possible, you know, how is it that people can come out of distress? Maybe something you might learn by reading about other people's examples and how they have come out of distress. Mm. But above all, it's also to give pleasure, to delight. If that happens, then I think literature is also doing an important function.
So finally, I mean, given all of these things kind of pulling you left, right, and center, I'm just curious how you are and have been celebrating what is a very exciting acknowledgement, the Nobel Prize for Literature.
Most of the time, I'm talking to you guys. But when I get a moment or two, I do sit down and celebrate quietly.
Abdulrazak Gurnah is this year's Nobel Laureate for Literature, the first winner of the award from East Africa. Abdulrazak, again, thank you very much for the conversation. Congratulations, and thank you for letting us invade your peace and quiet again.
That's okay. Thank you very much.
Learn more about Nobel laureate Abdulrazak Gurnah at our website, theworld.org. And while you're there, take some time to catch up with other recent stories on the world, including India's DNA COVID vaccine, the star-studded list of presidential candidates in the Philippines, and a rusting oil tanker off Yemen's coast that could cause a devastating oil spill. That's all at theworld.org. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime. On Twitter, we are @TheWorld. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.